Test.
All right. And push all the right buttons. And okay. Looks like we're fine. Let's do that.
Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Mavitvishavahai, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi, Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam, Sarvabhutaguhashayam, Yat Sarva Vishayatitam, Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha. Om. Good. Welcome to you all, and welcome also to the many students who attend this class online. We're continuing now with this wonderful Upadesha Sahasri. I keep saying again and again how much I enjoy it. It's the first time I'm teaching the text, and I think that's always something special for a teacher, the first time you teach a text, so I'm enjoying this especially much. I hope you are as well. So we started chapter 15. Remember, every chapter is independent, and we are in a section of the chapter that we'll see today in which Shankara, in some detail, addresses a problem. The technical word for it is deha vasana. Vasana here refers to the habitual identification with the body. And this identification runs very deep in almost every mind. And it's hard to root out because our sense of identity is so deeply connected, for obvious reasons, with their physical bodies. The moment you say, I'm a man or woman, you're referring to your body. Consciousness is neither male nor female. When you say you're tired, you're referring to your body. And we are so conditioned to do that. But there's another aspect to it. We're also highly identified with what the body does, karma. And actually, that's going to be Shankara's focus here. And that is the actions committed by our bodies. And we're highly identified with what our bodies do. I find it very interesting that when you introduce yourself to someone for the first time, hello, my name is Swami Taratmananda. I am a teacher of Vedanta. That expression, teacher of Vedanta, is not who I am, it's what I do. And not only what I do, it's what is done by this body and mind, not by consciousness. That is the kind of identification Sri Shankara wants to address in a series of verses. Chisel away at something? That's a common expression. He's going to work at reducing that deha vasana, that habitual identification with the body, in this series of verses. So we continue with verse 5. Yes. Swatma buddhim apekshyasau. Swatma buddhim apekshyasau. Vidhinam syat prayojakaha. Vidhinam syat prayojakaha. Jatyade shavavattena. Jatyade shavavattena. Tadvannanatmatanyata, tadvannanatmatatmayata. Swatma buddhim apeksha. Apeksha, with reference to swatma buddhim identification. Atma buddhi, you know, the attitude of being, of identifying something as oneself. So with regard to this problem of identification, now you have to jump around with me. End of that line, asau, that. Now go down to the third line. This is real common in Sanskrit verses, because of the meter needing to be followed, words get really scattered. So asau, this, and a particular identification he's going to discuss here, which is in a third line, jatyadihi. This identification with jati, etc. Jati is really refers to your birth, and in ancient times it referred to the caste into which you were born. Now that's quite less relevant today, but we'll be able to see how it relates to our, it does relate to our modern life completely. The condition of your birth really determines so much of your life. So I was just reading about the independence movement in Bangladesh. Horrifying stories. I've never looked into that before. Just horrible. Anyway, imagine if you were born in a Bangladeshi village. What would your life be like? So, think how different. You know, you probably would only go to a few years of school because children have to work in the paddy fields. And then you wouldn't even have the stability of home because every monsoon season you have to leave your home because those paddy fields all flood. What kind of life is that? Where would you be today if you were raised in that village? Amazing how much of our life is determined by the conditions of our birth. So in ancient times, it made sense for Shankara especially to refer to it in terms of the caste of the family into which you were born. But you can see in modern times, it's very relevant, the conditions of your birth. But Shankara is referring to caste here. He's not referring to being born in a village in Bangladesh. I'm adding that to make it more relatable. So understand it from Shankara's standpoint. He's saying that this identification with caste, etc., is an end of the second line, prayojakaha. It is the driving force, the impetus, vidhinan slap. Syat, for performing rituals. When you are born into a particular caste, there are certain rituals you are supposed to do associated with that caste. So the conditions of your birth determine here, in Shankara's thinking, determines what kind of rituals you have to do in your life. Shavavat, like the rituals that are done for a dead person, the commentator explains, if your mother or father dies, you are responsible to do rituals for them. Of course, in modern times, that may not be so, mother and father dying, we're responsible for making the arrangements for their funerals, etc. So that, whether it's done in a very Brahmanical manner or if it's done in a very American manner, we're still responsible for it. And we're responsible for it due to conditions of birth, but ultimately due to deha vasana, identification with the body. Suppose, let's see, and what he concludes here is tena, for this reason, Tatvat na. It is not like that, referring to Atma. Atma has no responsibilities based on conditions of birth. Atma wasn't born. Your body was born. Your body has a birth date. Your body also has an expiration date, like those packages in the stores. Not Atma. Unchanging consciousness. And just to make sure that this isn't left as a concept, the unchanging consciousness we're talking about is the consciousness that reveals the activities of your mind right now. Consciousness is, and this I stress this because this is crucial for Vedanta to work. Many people listen to Vedanta in a very conceptual way, and to do so really destroys the effectiveness of these teachings. So we want to ground it in the reality of our experience right now. The reality of the experience right now is you, in your essential nature, are the consciousness that reveals the activities of your mind. The activities of your mind are known to you, you, the conscious being. So that's the consciousness we're talking about. Shankara says, tena tadvat na. Atma is for tena, for this reason, for the what he's described in the first part of the verse. He says, Atma is not like that. Atma is not born into a particular family. Atma has no ritualistic responsibilities. And he says, anyata, otherwise, anatmata. Atma would not be Atma. And he's making a subtle comment here. He's saying, if Atma had responsibilities of doing rituals associated with birth, or if you have certain responsibilities in life, depending on your conditions of birth, then that Atma would have, if, you know, this is the, he is taking this contrary point of view, if Atma really has these responsibilities, like the one who got born so many years ago, then what happens when if Atma is the one who got born and has these responsibilities, then Shavavat, what happens when that body dies? It's a little obscure. Let me try to make his analogy more clear. If Atma is this body, mind, sense complex who is engaged in fulfilling responsibilities, then, like the body dies, Atma dies. And he says, na tadvat, Atma is not like that. Atma is not subject to death. And the point here, again, he's chipping away, that's a proper term, he's chipping away at this deha vasana. You're going to see a series of verses, each verse presenting an argument meant to help you let go of this habitual identification. Okay, let's continue. Na priya priya hit yukter, na priya priya hit yukter, na dehatvam kriya palam, na dehatvam kriya palam, deha yoga kriya hetus, deha yoga kriya hetu, tasmad vidwan kriyast yajet, tasmad vidwan kriyast yajet. Start in the third line. Deha yoga. Remember, yoga has many meanings, as any word does. Here, yoga means being associated with. Yoga, yuj, to join, in that sense. Deha yoga means being connected to a body, as we all seem to be right now. There are bodies sitting in chairs. Those bodies are what he's referring to. Deha yoga, being endowed with a body, getting a body, being born with a human body, he says, is kriya hetuhu. The cause for being born with a body is kriya, action. Action refers to actions done in a prior birth. And according to the doctrine of karma, you must have done some pretty good deeds in prior births to warrant being born as a human being. Because there are many other options, most of them, a few options are better than human beings, but by and large, the other options are being born as a cockroach or any other living beings. Some might not be so bad. To be born as a cat or dog in a very loving family might not be too bad. Somebody's taking care of you, giving you food and all of this stuff. But otherwise, it's generally considered that to be born as a human being is a result of tremendous good karma from perhaps hundreds or thousands of prior births. That's how it's understood. And the reason it's understood in that way is to stress the importance and value of this human life. You know, we take it for granted. We don't remember being born as cockroaches or anything, so we only have this life as a reference point, and it's not uncommon to take this life for granted. Many people waste away their years. Anyway, knowing that this life is so valuable, in the sense that it is a result of thousands of prior good deeds, then we should treat it with that kind of value, that kind of importance. Okay, so gaining a body is due to kriya, deeds, actions. And go up one line, second line, na adehatvam kriyapalam. So getting a body is a result of karma, but na adehatvam kriyapalam. By the way, kriyapalam and kriyahetuhu are synonyms. So pala, the result of kriya, the hetu, the result of kriya, hetu. So he is, what is he saying here? Getting a body is a result of good deeds. Not having a body is not the result of action. Na kriyapalam adehatvam. Now this is a strange expression. Adehatvam. And Shankara is picking up something. By the way, Shankara presumes here that you've all read the Chandogya Upanishad, especially the final chapter. He presumes. You know this, you've studied Chandogya, and you know in chapter 8, the final chapter, there's a famous story of Prajapati teaching Indra at the very end. And one of the things Prajapati teaches Indra is about adehatvam, the being bodiless. Now, what is in the, I'll just share with you a little bit the context in that dialogue. What does it mean to be bodiless? Consciousness has no body. Just interesting. Your body belongs to whom? I remember decades ago, my guru took this as a big topic, and he just explored it from this angle and that angle. who, and I think his discussion was, who has a right to your body? And then he looked at various things. Your parents have some right to your body, with regard to your body, especially if you're born in that village, your parents will depend on you to help out. He made other interesting observations. The state, government, has a has some right over your body. If your body is engaged in income-producing activities, the state wants a cut of that income, taxes. Anyway, he went on like this about who has a right, society has a right to your body. But then when he finally came to you, who is it that has a body? When you say, I have a body, who is that I? And clearly, it's not consciousness. Consciousness is one all-pervasive, changeless, unborn, uncreated consciousness. That consciousness doesn't possess a body. And as we've discussed in many prior chapters, as I just said, that consciousness is one. One and the same consciousness is present, illumining the activities of your mind and illumining the activities of my mind. It's the same consciousness. If you ask, you know, why don't I know your thoughts? That I is not consciousness. Follow this. This will lead us to an answer. When you say, Swamiji, if it's the same consciousness behind your mind and the same consciousness behind my mind, why don't I know your thoughts? And the question is, well, to answer that question, we have to inquire, who is asking the question? Why don't I know your thoughts? Does consciousness ask questions? Consciousness reveals questions in the form of thoughts in your mind. Consciousness doesn't ask anything. Consciousness doesn't have a mouth. Consciousness doesn't have confusion. Who has confusion? Who has thoughts? Who has questions? Now, those three are all traits of the mind. Your mind has questions. Your mind has confusion. Your mind has thoughts. And one of those thoughts is, why don't I know your thoughts? That's a thought. So a thought in your mind says, Swamiji, why don't I know your thoughts? Well, of course. Your thought is in your mind. My thoughts are in my mind. Those thoughts are absolutely separate, and it can't be otherwise. So we need to understand that properly. So now, who is that one who says, why don't I know your thoughts? The first part is, clearly, it is not consciousness. And who is it? In Sanskrit, we use the common word jiva. Jiva means a living being. And in this context, it refers to you as an individual being. Now things get a little messy here, because who are you as an individual being? As an individual being, are you pure consciousness? Well, that pure consciousness is one and all pervasive. We're talking about individual being, the one who's listening to this lecture right now. So, not consciousness. Is the individual being your mind? Now, this is a little complicated because mind is a thing. Like your body is a thing. And from the standpoint of the ancient rishis, your body is a thing made of elements. Your mind is also a thing made of elements. The body is made of physical elements. Mind is made of non-physical elements. The mind exists as a non-physical reality. A nice modern metaphor is when you have data on a computer chip. The computer chip might weigh a gram or two. How much does the data weigh? Does it mean the data doesn't exist? It exists as a non-physical reality. It has no weight, has no substance. So mind is like that. It exists, but not as a physical substance, as a physical existence. Point is, body is physical stuff, mind is physical, mind is non-physical stuff, consciousness is not an individual being. So how shall we define individual being as a combination of these? And one more factor. So if you add up consciousness plus mind and maybe plus body, and I say maybe because in a dream or in deep sleep, you don't, body is not part of your experience. So body part is optional, we'll call it, but absolutely required for this individual being is consciousness plus mind plus one more crucial factor. Body plus mind just means consciousness observing what's happening in your mind. But then who is asking that question? Why don't I know your thoughts? Consciousness doesn't ask it. Your mind is an inert thing. So this is very subtle. In your mind arises a particular thought. We'll call it a peculiar thought because it's so unlike all the other thoughts in your mind. In Sanskrit, we call it ahankara, usually translated as ego. And this is not in the sense of pride. This is in the sense of self-identification. Self-definition is a nice expression as well. How you define yourself, and it is in a form of a thought. When I ask you, who are you, can you give me a one-word answer? You could write a whole book if you want to write your autobiography. It wouldn't be 10 pages. It'd be a whole long book. This is who you are. Who you are is an amazingly complex being. But that amazingly complex being is referred to by a pronoun, I. When you use the word I, it represents that really complex being. It represents all of that. That whole 400-page autobiography that you'll never write is all represented by the word I. And that I is where the question comes from. That I is a thought illumined by consciousness. We said these two are required as a minimum. You can't have a thought. Can you have an unconscious thought? That, by definition, that doesn't make sense. We're not talking about the so-called unconscious mind. That's the realm of psychology. We're talking about your experience right now. Whatever, if you have a thought, you are conscious of that thought. So, the one who asks the question, and this is so counterintuitive, is a thought that pretends to be a conscious being. That's ahankara. We're talking about that sense of individuality, your self-definition. Your self-definition is a pile of thoughts and memories. How real is that? This is challenging. If your sense of being who you are is just a bunch of thoughts and memories, that explains why dementia is such a terrible thing, because you feel like you are getting lost. When your memories and thoughts that define who you are get lost, you're getting lost. It's like you are dying when you're still alive. Anyway, I'm being a little bit elaborate here to show that who it is, where are we here? Who is it? Let's go back to the verse. Who says, I have a body? Who says, I have a body? That I is a pronoun which refers to this really complex self-definition we call ego or ahankara. And the reason I'm taking the time to establish this is to make Shankara's point absolutely clear. Consciousness has no body. And that's why Shankara uses this term, adehatvam. And he presumes that you've read this part of the Chandogya Upanishad where Prajapati teaches Indra, by the way, that na priya priya iti ukdehe. Ukdehe, due to the statement, iti, thus, what statement? Na priya priya. So you're supposed to remember that those are the first words of Indra, of Prajapati saying to Indra, "Hey Maghavan," he addresses Indra, and he says, "Priya priya yoho apahatihi asti a shariram." So, in other words, what Shankara is quoting here, "Priya priya," is this little snippet. But the important part of the quotation is not priya and apriya. The important part of the quotation, he says, priya, priya, yo, priya, apriya, yoho, that which is desirable and undesirable, apahatihi asti. There is the cessation, there is a loss, there is a destruction of these two, and then there is a shariram. Notice Shankara uses a deham, a dehatvam, and the Chandogya uses a shariratvam. They mean the same thing. Bodilessness. So, all of this is to establish this point. Consciousness has no body. You are that consciousness, so in a manner of speaking, you, in your essential nature, have no body. You are bodiless. Now, that seems like an abstraction, but what it leads to is a healthy detachment from this body. We said deha vasana is a problem, that identification. To the extent that your body is you, you're stuck with all of its problems. To the extent that you have some healthy detachment from your body, to that extent, then the problems of the body belong to the body, they don't belong to you. So that healthy detachment is what Shankara is talking about here. And he concludes in the last line, tasmat, therefore, vidwan, a wise person, an enlightened person, don't translate it as scholar here, we're not talking about scholarship, the enlightened person, kriyah tyajet, should renounce kriyaha actions. So actions are performed by the body. You are bodiless. The one who is bodiless can perform. What can you do? being bodiless. We're going to see that Shankara is leading up to a point saying that Atma is not an agent of action. And when my guru taught this, he always liked to make this observation. Consciousness is not an agent of action. Consciousness doesn't do anything at all. Therefore, according to my guru, consciousness is useless. What a conclusion. He has said that many times. Okay, but the point here is that conventional life is based on intense activity for the sake of gaining peace, contentment, joy, happiness, etc., etc. And there's a price to be paid for all that intense effort. There's a lot of pain and struggle and difficulty encountered in all that process. So the wise person is one who abandons activity which is for the sake of contentment. The enlightened person, being already perfectly content, doesn't need to be engaged in activities for the sake of further contentment. Okay, we'll continue. Same theme. Karma swatma swatantraschen. Swatma swatma swatantraschen. Nivrittau chatate shyatam. Nivrittau chatate shyatam. Adehatve pale karye. Adehatve pale karye. Mnyate kuryat katam kriyaha. Mnyate kuryat katam kriyaha. On this one, we can take an order normal. Karmasu, we have to break the words apart, right? Karmasu, with regard to actions, Atma Swatantra Chet. If Atma is Swatantra, an independent agent of action. And let's just be very clear, Atma is not an independent agent of action. Who chose to come here for class today? Not consciousness doesn't make decisions. Remember, it's useless. So that decision-making process went on in your mind in the presence of consciousness. So, be clear. Consciousness didn't choose to come to class today. Decision-making process took place in your mind, and that process was revealed by consciousness, but that consciousness didn't make a decision. So Shankara argues here that if Atma, consciousness, is Swatantraha, if Atma is an independent, willful agent of action, then Nivrittau Cha Tata Ishyatam. Then Tata Ishyatam, it must also be accepted that Atma is an independent agent. Nivrittau is the opposite of karma. Karma is engagement in action. Nivritti is cessation from action. I'll paraphrase this first half. If Atma is an agent of action, Atma is also an agent of withdrawal from action. And when Shankara says withdrawal from action, he has one thing in mind, sannyasa. This is his, remember Shankaracharya was a sannyasi. All of his students were sannyasis, and so Shankara has this very strong orientation. But look at the point he's making here. If Atma is an agent of action, then Atma is also the agent of withdrawing from action, meaning becoming a sannyasi. If Atma chooses to do action, Atma can choose to become a sannyasi. and withdraw from action. Huh? We just said Atma is useless. It doesn't do anything. Atma didn't choose to come here. Atma doesn't choose to become a sannyasi. Now, the point Shankara makes here is adeha tve pale akarye, since adeha tve, he's using that word again. Adeha, we've seen as asharira and adeha tve, all meaning the same thing, bodilessness. And Shankara here uses that as a code word for moksha, liberation. To be enlightened is to know that you, as pure consciousness, you have no body. There is a body out here, but it's not your body. As we said, it belongs to your mother and father, belongs to the state, belongs to society, belongs to the IRS, etc. It doesn't belong, and it belongs to that one who wrote that 400-page autobiography, the one who didn't write that 400-page autobiography. That one owns a body, not consciousness. So, and that bodilessness, pale akarye, since that bodilessness is the pala, the result of akarya, not action. Gaining moksha is not the result of action. Can you follow the logic? Action is done by the body. How does that help? How will that help the problem of bondage? Actually, let me just, this is a big topic, we'll just touch on very briefly, but most of you understand that the root problem, according to Advaita Vedanta, is ignorance in the form of self non-recognition, failure to recognize your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. I don't want to go into all the details here, but your true nature is already Satchidananda Atma, but that true nature is not necessarily recognized. It is said to be veiled by ignorance in a manner of speaking. So, what removes ignorance? Does, and this is one of the most important things that Shankara really focuses on, does action remove ignorance? Go to the gym and work out. You'll be healthier, you'll be stronger. But that self non-recognition remains. Action doesn't remove that ignorance. Knowledge, spiritual wisdom, removes that ignorance. So for this reason, since action doesn't lead to moksha, bodilessness, Shankara concludes, then actually he has a rhetorical question, then katam, then why nyate, when this is known, when you understand that action doesn't make you enlightened, then katam kriyah kuryat, then why engage in actions? If you know that let me put it in different words. If you know that perfect peace and contentment is not the result of anything you do. I'll say that again. Reflect on this. Suppose you recognize this truth, that perfect peace and contentment is not the result of anything that you can do. What you can do is create a little bit of peace and contentment, moments of peace and contentment, but no one is satisfied with a moment of peace and contentment. We want continual, uninterrupted peace and contentment, that's moksha, and that is not the result of anything you do. Knowing this, you recognize the futility of all action. And in this context, we can add something here, although Shankara may argue with me. The futility of all action, becoming a sannyasi is an action. Right? He says, if Atma is the agent of action, Atma is also the agent of withdrawal from action, taking to a life of sannyasa. So that means that taking sannyasa, becoming a monk, will not make you enlightened. Full stop. And that's absolutely correct. Shankara at this point would argue here. If he spoke American English, he would say, yeah, but. But from Shankara's standpoint, it's hard to gain enlightenment without sannyasa. And remember, his standpoint is highly biased. He is a sannyasi. He was teaching sannyasis. So naturally, he's going to lean in that direction. But he wouldn't argue with what I just told you. Taking sannyasa won't make you enlightened. Full stop. Okay, we'll see one more verse today. This concludes this discussion about the futility of action. and the problem of identification, a deha vasana. Let's see this. Yes. Jatyadin samparityajya. Jatyadin samparityajya. Nimittam karmanam buddhaha. Nimittam karmanam buddhaha. Karma hetu viruddham yata. Karma hetu viruddham yata. Swarupam shastrata smaret. Swarupam shastrata smaret. Samparityajya. Completely giving up. And Shankara is not talking about sannyasa here, because we just saw this kind of renunciation of action, renunciation of duties, renunciation of seeking worldly pleasure, renunciation of conventional worldly activities, this action will not, in and of itself, lead to moksha. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying samparityajya, completely giving up, not worldly activities. He says completely giving up jatyadin, identification with the circumstances of your birth. Or kind of more literally, identification with the caste of your family in ancient times. So he's not talking about taking sannyasa here, but rather the complete disidentification with the conditions of your birth, which gives rise to an individual person with certain responsibilities. And those responsibilities are the nimittam karmanam, are the driving force for action. He is echoing what he said in the first of our four verses today. And who is that one? Buddha, an enlightened person. Notice it's not Buddha, which is a participle here. Buddha, an enlightened person. One who has wisdom. Buddha. That enlightened person, having completely given up identification with the circumstances of birth, which means everything in your unwritten 400-page autobiography. So think about it. That unwritten 400-page autobiography represents you. take that autobiography and burn it. What's left? Interesting. If you burn that autobiography, what's left? Consciousness, which has no boundaries, no limits, no problems, no headaches. The consciousness, which is a deha, has no physical body. So therefore, if there is a headache, the headache belongs to the body, not to consciousness, which is a deha. So Shankara says here that yat karma hetu virudham swarupam smaret shastrataha. He says, he's giving you some directions. It's like a plan. What is a plan? There are many steps in this plan. The first step is to recognize that 400-page autobiography is not the essence of who you are. The essence of who you are is consciousness. You know, isn't it your experience right now that the most simple and direct meaning of that pronoun I is the one who knows what's happening right now? Can't get more fundamental than that. The fundamental sense of I, who am I? I am the one asking the question. I am the one who knows the presence of the question in my mind. Correct? When you say, who am I, is that question known or unknown? Known. Known to whom? Consciousness. That's your essential nature. So that consciousness then should be the focus of your attention. Not your physical body and the actions it's engaged in, but if you're serious about gaining spiritual growth and reaching enlightenment, if you're serious, then what? First, break this habitual identification with the body and mind, samparityajya, and then part two, or step two, he says, smaret. You should focus your mind, literally it means remember, but in context, you should focus your attention on what? Yet, that which is your swarupam, your essential nature as consciousness. And that essential nature as consciousness is karma hetu virudham. It is opposed to the it is not the cause for action. Karma hetu virudham. It is not engaged. It is not an agent of action. So what he's saying here, I'll paraphrase, is if what you really want is perfect peace and uninterrupted contentment, should recognize, smarit, you should recognize how, shastrataha, that according to the scriptures, you should pay attention, because the scriptures will tell you that perfect peace and uninterrupted contentment cannot be gained through anything you do. That's his point. Limitations of what we can accomplish. Absolutely, we can improve the quality of our lives, we can improve the lives of our loved ones, and we can contribute a lot, we can make incremental improvements in our lives, but not perfect peace and uninterrupted contentment. The only way that can be done is by shifting your focus away from action and the body engaged in those actions, you shift from action to seeking knowledge, wisdom. And this is Advaita Vedanta. It's not what you do, it's what has everything to do with your worldview. Let me just add one comment here at the end of the class. And that is, we experience the world and our lives through the lens of our minds. And I think you're familiar with this kind of concept, and that is, we interpret everything according to our worldview. Some people have a pessimistic worldview. Some people have an optimistic worldview, like, as a simple example. So we experience the world and our lives according to our worldview. Vedanta addresses the problem of suffering by radically changing that worldview. Doesn't change your life, doesn't change the world, but it does change your worldview. Means it changes how you interpret events in your life. And so often we interpret negatively. Like, you know, the pessimist, the glass is half empty. Somebody who has that attitude in every situation, that person is unhappy. Well, that's easy to address. Get rid of that pessimism, and then all those sources of sadness will be removed. Vedanta does that on a radical scale. Not just improving your worldview, but giving you a radically different worldview in which you become free from suffering. So this is why there's such a focus on gaining spiritual wisdom and not a focus on what you do. Notice the tremendous emphasis nowadays on doing yogasanas. So will you ever gain enlightenment by doing yoga? Now, they're helpful. I won't deny that the asana practice can be helpful, but just be very, very clear. No amount of yogasana practice can possibly make anyone enlightened. However, I'll end with this observation. People are very quick to put down the Western style practice of yoga. They said, "Oh, they're just doing it They're doing it for their bodies. They're doing it to look good. Or they're doing it for stress reduction and all of this stuff." And it's actually the origin of it, of course, is part of a practice leading to enlightenment. But this is it. For many Western seekers, it works like this. They come for physical exercise and they slowly get converted to seek something more. How wonderful is that? In advertising, they call that bait and switch. Anyway, that's good. This is a good place to stop. We'll continue next week. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat. Okay, stop.